What's up, gamers, and welcome to Lost at Sea Gaming. I am Hulking Yoda, the captain of this ship, the SS Gamer. And you have just stepped inside my captain's quarters, my weekly gaming update show where I talk about my favorite gaming news topic of the past week, discuss what games I've been playing, give tips on some of those games, as well as issue a weekly relevant gaming-related decree. This week, it's all about the question of, is Ubisoft in danger of ruining the Assassin's Creed franchise yet again? So let's talk about it and dive right into the episode with my news catch of the week. Gamers, if you've listened to me for any amount of time, you'll probably know that I am a massive fan of the Assassin's Creed franchise. I have even gone on record as many times before saying that it is arguably my favorite gaming franchise currently right now on the market. And I would still stick by that at this point in time. There's just something about them. I love the combination of the history and the gameplay and just the lore between the Isu and the Assassins and the Templars. It really scratches multiple itches for me and always has since that first game. So I love this series. I get so excited anytime there's a new one announced or there's a new one coming out. So it really piqued my interest this past week when I saw that there was actually a report that Ubisoft is currently working on 11 Assassin's Creed titles, which are a mix of single player, multiplayer, mobile, and VR. So I was kind of baffled when I saw this. I'm like, man, are they really doing 11 games? I knew of the four that were announced last year at the Assassin's Creed Showcase event, but man, seven more titles? Wow, where is this coming from? Now, the first question I have to ask, though, is why? Why is Ubisoft doing so many Assassin's Creed titles all at the same time? Well, they did recently go on record as saying that they were going to be putting most of their chips into the Assassin's Creed franchise because it is their top dollar earning franchise. So I get it. You know, this is your top franchise in your company. But that doesn't necessarily mean that you want to go out there and start making 11 games at once and oversaturating the market. Because my issue with the gamers is Ubisoft has already done this before, and it was a lot less games than 11. Now, granted, the 11 they're talking about, again, it's a mixture of all kinds of different types of genres and platforms to play and experience them on, but it doesn't change the fact that they're all still Assassin's Creed titles. So I don't think that it matters, in my opinion, when it comes to oversaturation, whether it's different platforms and different styles of games. Sure, that can have an effect on it, the reception, whether positive or negative, but I still feel like if you have currently all around the span of a couple of months, five Assassin's Creed titles release, you're still going to be a little oversaturated and people are going to be kind of like, yeah, you're bound to suffer somewhere. And then if in a year or more later, you're going to release two more Assassin's Creed titles, so on and so forth. I really am worried, to be honest with you gamers, because I thought that Ubisoft had learned from their mistakes in the past. When they released Assassin's Creed Rogue on the same day as Assassin's Creed Unity, because they wanted to have, and it was commendable what their reasoning was, they wanted the last gen players to still have one final Assassin's Creed title for a send-off for that generation if they weren't able to yet upgrade to the next gen and get Unity. I get it, but I still think it was too much because you had year after year after year, ever since the release of Assassin's Creed 2, you had Assassin's Creed 2, and then Brotherhood, and then Revelations, and then you had so on and so forth. So my point is, there was just way too many titles releasing, and there wasn't a whole lot of room to breathe for gamers. These aren't very quick hit games like Call of Duty that we're releasing every year, or that people don't necessarily play for single player. They play for multiplayer or map pack. So there's somewhat of an added reasoning to going back to them. They're not these longer story-driven games. So I think it's a little bit of different approach that needs to be taken with the series, a little bit more TLC. And, you know, personally, I didn't feel like any of those games were under quality. I know that Unity had a rough launch. I personally didn't experience that roughness. I never had any issues in that game except for one time Arno fell through the ground and into the abyss of the cyberspace there within the game and the code of the game. But outside of that, I never had any issues whatsoever with that game. Absolutely loved it. So again, why would Ubisoft be doing this? Well, I think it's pretty public knowledge that Ubisoft has kind of been struggling financially and really trying to kind of figure out how it's going to be able to course correct and make some profits. They had a very underprofitable fourth quarter, and you know, they blamed it on different things here or there. But at the end of the day, they're not doing so well financially. So they're looking for a massive influx of revenue cash, or at least what I would say is a revenue flow that they feel confident in, that they're going to get some bang for their buck back. So what better way to do that than to rely on your most popular and most profitable franchise? You know, the other part to this answer is why? Well, I mean, Assassin's Creed Valhalla was just announced recently as their first $1 billion game. The game's been out for a few years now, I get it, but it also had a ton of content that helped continuing to support the game and keeping people's interests over the last few years. So there's a lot of reason why that game crossed that $1 billion mark for them. I don't really know that I could speak to any game in Ubisoft's portfolio outside of maybe Rainbow Six that had that kind of sustained support. I don't even think The Division had that kind of sustained support. So there is a reason why Valhalla, not to mention it was a great game, but it had a ton of support and people kept coming back to it over the course of those years. You can't have or expect, and I hope they don't expect, to have a $1 billion release with every Assassin's Creed title, especially when you're releasing the quantity or look to be releasing the quantity that you are rumoring or putting out there that you're in development on. Now, what are these 11 that are being rumored to be in development? Well, Mirage obviously comes out this October, October 12th, as of right now in this recording, and that's their next title in the series. So that is one of the 11. The games that were shown off last year at the Assassin's Creed Showcase, which were Nexus, the VR game, Jade, Red, and Hexae, all four of those are all part of these 11 as well. So we have five right there if you're keeping count. One that I'm not too sure exactly what this is supposed to be all about, but Invictus is another one in here. And then we have Nebula and Raid, which are actually supposed to be multiplayer specific games, which I got to talk about that here in a second. Outside of that, we have a code name Echoes, which sounds pretty cool. Kind of very interested to see what that is all about. And then we have two final completely rumors right now, but a sequel to Nexus apparently is already being discussed internally. And then the big head scratcher for me, which is a Black Flag remake. And I'll get to my thoughts on that here in a bit. But when we come to looking at the multiplayer specific games, I got a question. Why? Again, that's the big question for me in this discussion is why Ubisoft? I get it. You had some pretty cool, innovative ideas with the multiple multiplayer entries that you tacked on as gameplay options on some of your previous games in the series. And I tried multiplayer on a lot of those entries because I was all about maintaining a consistency of getting all 1,000 gamer score on every Assassin's Creed game. And to do that in a lot of those games, you had to play multiplayer. So I thought it was fun. They did some really cool stuff with the multiplayer, even with co-op. That was really fun going through with my son at the time and going through and knocking out missions. And it was a lot of fun, don't get me wrong. But I don't necessarily know that that is what your typical returning Assassin's Creed fan or customer is looking for. So it brings that question mark and that head scratch to me and like, okay, why are you, maybe they're trying to go and attract a different crowd. The Call of Duty crowd, the Fortnite crowd, the crowd that prefers and loves multiplayer games. Nothing wrong with that. So maybe they're trying to branch out and get away from just story-focused, narrative-driven games and try to attract a crowd that is really focused on multiplayer and those co-op and social experiences. If that's the case, I get it. I still don't think it'll help prevent you from an oversaturation. Even if you're like, oh, well, we'll release the multiplayer game parallel to the single-player game, so we have something for everybody. I'm not really buying into that. I still think that the fact that you have two, or if you were to hypothetically have two titles on the market around the same time that both say Assassin's Creed in the box, I still think it's going to be a detriment to you. The VR games, I get it. That's very much of a what I would consider a niche market. So I feel like you could still have the virtual reality experiences while still having your regular Assassin's Creed narrative driven story focused games every 2 years if they get back on that release pattern. But when we get to multiplayer, I very much am confused as to why. Now, another answer to that, though, in my opinion, I think they are hoping for and looking at dollar signs. Potential, again, revenue cash flow is what they're looking for and what they need to be sustained as a company. And if they look at multiplayer, if they're saying, hey, look, Assassin's Creed is our top franchise, multiplayer, you can get a ton of money from reoccurring players, season passes, battle passes, weapon skins, all kinds of stuff that you can get all this different revenue from. Let's possibly see if we can crack into that market with the Assassin's Creed name. I think that's what they're probably thinking, or at least a lot of what they're thinking. But at the end of the day, it's about the money. It's about the cash flow, the revenue. In my opinion, I think so. It's a business at the end of the day. It's a business from Ubisoft's perspective. I know we like to romanticize that all these developers and publishers, they're all about the gamers and about pleasing us. A lot of times, yeah, sure. And that's definitely a part of it. I won't take that away from any of them. But at the end of the day, ultimately, these are businesses. These are business practices that are being done to ensure there is a profit in what they're doing. So the next question, the biggest head scratcher to me was a Black Flag remake. I don't see the purpose in that at all. I get it. It's your highest selling Assassin's Creed game at 15 million copies, your fifth biggest selling game of all time for Ubisoft as a company. But at the same time, I don't feel it's necessary. I don't think that we need a remake of any Assassin's Creed game, to be honest with you, except for I would be on board with the original Assassin's Creed being remade with today's tech. Just as kind of like a, almost like a swan song for Altair. He only got one game, and it was the start of the franchise, and that is the least, from a gameplay option standpoint, and the functionality and the fluidity of what we have today with Assassin's Creed, I can only imagine what the original game would be like if it had the games from today's mechanics. I think that would make a lot of perfect sense. Don't think it's going to happen. They've already kind of closed the door on that because we thought we were going to potentially see the official announcement or reveal of that at last year's October showcase that I referenced earlier. We did not. We kind of got the book closed and said we are not working on a remake of the original game. So it is what it is, but if there is a Black Flag remake, I'm just really disappointed in Ubisoft in that sense, if that's what we're doing here, Ubisoft. But at the end of the day, I am really just hoping that Mirage is a solid experience. I hope that it's profitable and successful for them. But I have to say, I don't think it's going to be up there with other Assassin's Creed games. I definitely don't think it's going to be up there with Valhalla. And the reason why is because Ubisoft really hasn't put it out there. Like, it needs to be this must-play game. It's kind of all just kind of been marketed as, hey, it's kind of almost like a side story, or, you know, just following Bassam and his origins. Kind of a, you know, hyped up expansion to Valhalla still. And to be honest, as far as I'm aware, this started out as an expansion piece or added content to Valhalla, and that they decided to branch it off as its own separate experience and game. So they probably saw that they were way behind on development with the Assassin's Creed Red and all these other titles. They were like, oh, we need something. So you know what? Let's market Mirage as not just an expansion or DLC, but as its own game. And don't get me wrong. I do think it looks like it's going to be awesome, and it's going to be a full fleshed out Assassin's Creed game, but in that classic original Assassin's Creed style, which is one thing I'm looking forward to getting back to after all these massive RPG worlds, which, again, clarify, I absolutely loved all three of them between Origins, Odyssey, and Valhalla. But it'll be a nice kind of little break to go back to those classic 50-hour games, at least for me, 50-hour games. So ultimately, I think that Ubisoft, if they are actually, in fact, working on 11 titles at once, plus those other two potential rumored, you know, the Nexus sequel, as well as maybe a Black Flag remake, if they're doing all this, I think that's just a little bit too much. And I really hope that they just kind of dial it back or have a really good pacing planned for the release of these titles. Because if you try to release too many of these at once in any given year, I'm just afraid that we are going to show history repeat itself, and you're going to push away all the fans that you got back, new and old, with the relaunch of Origins and kind of the franchise back in 2017. So only time will tell. I'll keep you posted, you best believe, as I continue to see more things announced online, and I'll be right here to talk about it and discuss it with you guys. Now let's go open up my captain's log and see what games I've been playing. Gamers, it's been a couple of weeks since my last Captain's Quarters episode, and therefore my last foray into my captain's log. So as I open up the log and turn the page, the first and only game this week I want to discuss with you is Final Fantasy 16. Gamers, as I mentioned, it has been 2 weeks since my last Captain's Quarters, and in that Captain's Quarters, I told you my first impressions of Final Fantasy 16, discussed my first 15 hours spent within the game. Well, in these last 2 weeks, believe it or not, I have dropped another 30 hours into this game for a total of 45 hours so far in the world of Valestia, which is the name of the world in the game. Now, that 45 hours puts me at 68% main story completion per the PS5 UI dashboard. So if you don't know, the PS5 had an update a few months ago that I absolutely love that shows you the amount of hours you've put into a game as well as the percentage completion as you progress through the game's main story. So 68% complete with that main story, 45 hours in, and I still feel like there is a ton of content. Not just the 32% left of the main story, of course, but also a lot more to come. And the reason why, I'll kind of get into those details here in a few minutes, but let's just kind of go back to where I left you off at. And since then, there has been so much. I mean, so much. I mean, yes, it's 30 hours that I'm sitting here trying to cram into maybe 10 minutes to discuss with you what I've loved about this game so far. But man, I don't even know where to begin, to be honest. First, let me just say that this story, this is one thing I really just could not scream loud enough from the tops of the buildings of Philadelphia, how amazing this story is. And if you didn't know, I say Philadelphia because I live in Philly. So this story has just been absolutely resounding with me, just so resonating. And it rightfully so has gotten a lot of comparisons online to the Game of Thrones style of approach towards a fantasy epic. And I definitely absolutely believe and agree with that 1,000%. And I love it. I talked about last week how in my Captain's Decree, was there a reason for there to be such division over the fact that there is the Game of Thrones style of story here in a Final Fantasy game? I'm all about it, guys. I mean, honestly, the Final Fantasy series has been around for years, decades, and I mean, there has been so many different types of stories and characters, and at this point, why not try something different and go this more adult, mature route with the story? So the story has just continued to just amaze me. I love the characters. I mean, the main character and protagonist of Clive Rossfield is just really awesome. I mean, yeah, he's that brooding kind of guy, but I felt like Noctis, the main character in Final Fantasy XV, was the same way, but I still loved him. I feel like I'm going to give the nod to Clive, though, in this context. I mean, Noctis was great, but man, there is just something about Clive that really resonates with me and him as a character, his story, his character arc, because that arc has started to take a turn as well for me in a good way over the course of this 30 hours since I last talked to you. And I love what the game does and taking place over the course of many, many years. I mean, at this point, I want to say that I've probably spent in the span of almost 20 in-game years from the point of the beginning of the game, which is, say, the prologue. If you played the demo, the prologue, from that point until where I'm at now in the story, timeline-wise, there's been about 20 years that has passed. And there is just so much that has happened over the course of that 20 years. I can't go into too many details with you because I do not want to spoil any of the really fun stuff that you guys can experience for yourselves as you're playing through it. But a lot of things also that I have loved over the course of this 30 hours. So one thing that really stands out to me is the fact that this game is the game that keeps on giving. And what I mean is it keeps on giving brand new gameplay content. I mean, there's just constantly new abilities, elemental abilities, new icons to control or to draw from as far as your elemental abilities are concerned. You have new, the Limit Break, gamers, the Limit Break. I completely, as a Final Fantasy fan, a lifelong gamer and Final Fantasy fan, I completely forgot about the Limit Break. Can you believe that? That tells you how long it's been since I've actually really played into a Final Fantasy game. Point being, when they brought out the Limit Break, I'm like, oh man, this is awesome. And of course, it's typical. It kind of reminds me of a lot of games do this, but I really go to God of War in my mind, where you click in the two analog sticks when you have the meter built up and you transform and you go into this crazy all-out mode. And just, you can still take damage though. You still take damage. So you want to still utilize your dodging and movements like that and watch out for attacks from enemies. But the amount of attacks you can get off and the amount of damage that you inflict during this mode is just awesome. And if you've been a Final Fantasy fan for years, you'll know what I'm talking about when I say limit break, and you'll be able to understand and agree that, hey man, limit breaks, they are pretty crucial and awesome when it comes to the combat in Final Fantasy, any Final Fantasy. Now, there's been a lot of really cool stuff that's happened boss fight wise too. And also icons, new icons, which are basically the term that is used for the massive creatures that used to be summoned creatures in all the previous games. Well, I met different icons like Typhon and Ultima. And let me just say, story-wise, I will not get into the details of how that happens or what they really mean. But, oh man, gamers, I was super excited. I'm sitting there and I'm like, yo, I completely forgot about Ultima and Typhon. I keep honestly enjoying being surprised by some of these summons, because I think that over the years, you know, it's just kind of at the forefront of my mind. I think and know and always will know and remember icons or summons like Ifrit and Shiva and Odin and Bahamut and ones like that, the ones that are kind of the regulars, if you will. But not that Ultima and Typhon haven't been in multiple Final Fantasy games. I just completely forgot about them. And man, gamers, the way that they are represented in this game, woo! I absolutely love what Square Enix did with those icons in this game and its story and the context they're used in. Oh man, content is what I was talking about too. New content just kind of being drip fed to you throughout the course of the game. So it's not just limit breaks. We also get a lot of stuff side quest wise. So one thing I had mentioned was, you know, side quest at that point in the game, in the first 15 hours, they were very much like old school style fetch quests, if you will. And I had read and heard that, hey, the more you play into the game, these things actually flesh out and open up a little bit more. And there actually is going to be side quests with context and purpose and just play a little bit further into the game. And that's 100% true. So just like I had said last week, where if you're worried that the game is too linear and there's not really a lot of room for exploration in the environment you're going through, just like I had said then in regards to that, where, look, just keep playing through that first portion of the game, and once you get to a certain point, things will open up and you'll have bigger areas to explore. It's the same thing 100% when it comes to the side quests and the quantity of content within those side quests is the best way I know how to describe it. So I've thoroughly enjoyed doing a ton of side quests. Every time I get new side quests pop up on the map when I'm in the hideaway or in a new village or somewhere like that, immediately before going out into my next adventure into the main story, I always make sure to clear up those side quests first. And a lot of times, I mean, you get a lot of really cool items for it. You get some new crafting items for crafting new weapons or gear or armor. So there's a lot of incentive to do it as well. Well, one thing as far as new drip-fed content that I got during this past 30 hours, there is a new hunting board, which is very familiar to RPG fans, like fans of The Witcher and so on. There's many games out there that have these kinds of things, but Final Fantasy 16 has a hunting board where you can go up to, and there are specific notorious marks is what they're called, and basically they're graded A, B, C, so on and so forth, and it's kind of cool the way they do it, because they do kind of give you a general area of the map where these things are going to be. But in some cases, you had to kind of read the little mini story that's kind of like a paragraph with these creatures that you can read when you look at them on the hunter board. And these stories are kind of cool because you kind of have to piece together where exactly these creatures are going to be found at. And then you hunt them down and then you fight them. And these are actually pretty intense fights. I mean, these are no joke. There's been some that obviously are easier than others, but I would definitely say once you get into B and especially into the A rank enemies, these marks, they can give you a run for their money. And they're pretty fun fights, in my opinion. So we have different creatures I've come across, like Dazmir the Griffin and the giant single-eyed winged monstrosity, Ahriman. So I have loved having that added to just as something else optionable to do within the game. Now, if you know me, I have also talked about how much I just love the lore and the richness and depth of lore within this game world. And it just absolutely impresses me how much I feel like how much time and effort and thought from Square Enix went into creating this world. Because it's not just a game world and you kind of have a few backstories here or there and that's kind of it. I mean, there is a rich, deep history within each of these two continents, the twins as they're known, the continents of Storm and Ash. One is called Storm, one is called Ash. That's just kind of cool names for me anyways. I'm a glutton for that kind of stuff. And then you think about all the different Dalmekian Republic and the Imperials and all these different governments and factions that are all throughout the land, and then the histories behind them and things that have happened in the past and battles, and then just the history behind the Mother Crystals, these giant, massive mountain-sized crystals that give the world its magic and the story behind them. I mean, just I could go on forever and ever and have a whole episode just about the lore and the history of this world, and I absolutely love it. If you remember in the last episode when I talked about the game Tomes as a character, that Hippocrates is his real name, but Tomes is what he goes by, ironically. And you go back to him in between adventures and you basically level up your historian level. And as you do that, the way you do that is basically it's as if Clive is explaining to Hippocrates his adventures, all the new enemies and characters and lands that he's come across in those adventures since the last time they talked. And basically it'll update basically all these different bestiaries and landmark descriptions and character descriptions, and you just have access to all that information. I absolutely loved it. I still love it, but the game has now added something else that is also very unique and I have thoroughly loved as well. This is a new character in the Hideaway where I'm at currently. And it's essentially like the Hideaway's historian, if you will. A little bit more involved with the map aspect of things than Tomes is the written word, if that makes sense. And so basically you can go to Vivian and meet up with her, and she has basically this whole interconnected web of characters. And you can go to either that option with her, or you can go to a table that has the map of the world. And it has all these different icons on it, all the different towns and history and things that have happened within the towns during the time period of these 20 years that I told you that the game has taken place of so far. So you have all these different things that you have done that you can look back on in the map and kind of refresh your memory on, whether it's names of characters or locations or battles or creatures or icons. I personally have been really enjoying doing that because I find that it helps me to retain the information. I can therefore remember better the names of characters, the locations of certain things in the game, and that way when they're referenced later on in cutscenes or just in dialogue, I'll know what they're talking about. That's how deep I am into it, gamers. And that I just thought was an awesome addition. For people like me, if you really wanted to get into the depth of it all, you can go there to Vivian. You can see how all the characters interconnect, how they've changed over the last 20 years. It grays out characters that may have died over the course of that time at this point. There's just so much content here. It is amazing. So I talked about also new elements added to combat, and I do have a lot more now at my disposal than I last did. So before I just had fire and wind, well, now I have two more added to that repertoire, and that is lightning as well as earth. So now I have both of those elements, and I'll be honest with you, lightning at first for me was kind of like, I'm not really digging this, but the more I used it, and especially lightning rod, gamers, I'm going to tell you right now, do not sleep on that. I'll get to that in my buried treasure segment. But let me just say that I've ultimately grown to really like both earth and lightning as far as the elements and implementing them in battle. The one thing that frustrates me, though, the game does limit you to 3 equipped elements at a time. So you have to choose. And it's just like, man, I really wish you allowed me access to all of these at a given time in battle. But it's still really, really cool once you get your flow of combat and your combos going and understand how to utilize the abilities to each element to the best of your capabilities within a given battle, whether it's just a random battle in the field or if it's a boss or if it's a mark that I was talking about earlier, one of those notorious marks from the Hunter's Board. I mean, there's just, oh man, it's awesome. I absolutely love the combat in this game. I love it so much. Arguably my favorite combat in a Final Fantasy game to this date. I will go on record as saying that. Now, finally, I will share with you where I am currently at as I've made my way to the Velcroid Desert. And, you know, typically I get this way in every game I play just about. I'm like, oh, it's a desert area. But I got to be honest with you. Horizon Forbidden West, The Legend of Zelda, Skyward Sword HD, and then now Final Fantasy 16. All three of those games, I've gotten to the desert area. I'm like, it's a desert area. And then absolutely ended up just immensely loving these areas. So specifically the Velcroid Desert, it starts out just like any other desert you would think. It's this just massive sea of emptiness ahead of you, of sand and rocks and desolate brown withered looking plants and things like that. But in the distance, you see the oasis, and there's this little village that's actually a pretty decent sized village as I say that now. And you go in there, and this village has just this awesome story, multiple story moments in it. Multiple side quests that are really, really cool. It's the desert village of Dalamil. And you meet a lot of really interesting characters here. Again, you go through some really great main story stuff, some great side quests. And it's just a fun little place to be, in my opinion. I thought it was just a lot of fun. I had a ton of fun, actually, exploring and interacting with characters here, picking up side quests and performing them for those people, as well as the areas surrounding it. Because the desert is just an open desert leading up to it. But then after, on the other side of the Dalamil village, there's actually these limestone deposits that have these absolutely gorgeous turquoise waters and springs. There's a river that flows through the Dalamil village that's these turquoise-colored waters. And it's an absolutely gorgeous location to explore. And, you know, before this, there was the forest in the very beginning of the game that I was like, man, the density of this forest and visually, it's so amazing. This is my favorite area so far. I got to be honest with you, that desert, the amount of enjoyment that I got out of that desert this past week, that might have been enough to take my favorite spot in the game so far. But ultimately, I did make it through some really amazing story beats with some of the major characters in the game as far as antagonists on their side of the story, if you will. And I don't want to say any names because I don't want to give away the point in the game where these things happen or anything like that. But let me just say, God, this story just continues to just enthrall me. And I just absolutely love it. I have loved my 45 hours in Final Fantasy 16 so far. I can't wait to share with you the continued progress that I have week to week as I continue to play through. At this point, 68% complete overall with the main story, 45 hours. I'm thinking it may end up being every bit of 80 hours before I'm done with this game with everything that I want to do in it. And that's perfectly okay with me. Now, out of all that, now let's go find out what my highlight of the week was. Gamers, when it comes to trying to pick out of 30 hours in Final Fantasy 16, what was my highlight in that 30 hours time? Honestly, it came there at the very end of it. Now, I thoroughly enjoyed every second of that time, but for me, it was like I was just ending the captain's log talking about. I loved the Velcroid Desert. There was just something about it. I absolutely loved the visuals. Every time I turned around, I had not done this in a while in the game. Every time I turned around, I was stopping to do photo mode and taking a shot and lining up a picture of this just gorgeous limestone depository with the turquoise waters accented off of it and some palm trees, and then turn around over here and there's just this beautiful golden desert and some old relic looking structure in the distance that's half buried in the sand. And even the enemy types, I enjoyed the scorpions that you face across the desert and other different vultures and flying creatures. And just in general, the music got me really going. I just really did love the village of Dalamil. It was just something about it. I thoroughly, thoroughly enjoyed everything that was wrapped up around that desert and the size of it too. I mean, you first go out and there's kind of a linear path that leads you into this massive center desert area. And then from that center area, you can go to the northern desert or the southern desert. And then there's branching paths outside of those as well. I was only able to go on the one branching path, the central desert and the southern desert. So I still have the entire northern desert plus multiple little branching paths that I wasn't yet accessible to. So I can't wait to go back and see what else is out there for me to explore and to find. And I'm sure there's probably going to be some more notorious marks out there. I did come across one, which was an Adamantoise. And if you're a Final Fantasy fan, then you'll recognize that enemy type. Adamantoise is another one that has been in Final Fantasy just about every game. This one is very different than what I've used to or been used to in more recent Final Fantasy games. I mean, even going back to Final Fantasy 13, the Adamantoids was, I mean, like a skyscraper-sized giant. Whereas in this game, it's still a massive-sized turtle. I mean, don't get me wrong. It's pretty massive comparatively to a human being. So it's still pretty big, but it's not skyscraper big. And it's actually pretty funny. Clive actually makes a comment when they come across the first Adamantoids. Man, this is huge. And me and my wife had talked about it. She's a huge Final Fantasy fan as well, and said, you know, I wonder if that's kind of like an inside joke to Final Fantasy fans. Like, yeah, that's really big, huh? Okay. Because we know what we've seen before. So exploring the desert, doing the mark, doing the side quest, enjoying the time in the village of Dalamil, and just in general, the visuals. I mean, it was just an absolute blast to explore that area. And out of that 30 hours that I played, probably close to 3 hours of it was spent in those locations. So that tells you, I mean, a tenth of my time was there, and there's still that much more to explore and go back to. So I can't wait. And that's I mean, honestly, what else more could you ask for from a highlight than an area that you've been to that you can't wait to get back to and see what more it has to offer? Now let's go open up a chest of buried treasure gaming tips I have for you in Final Fantasy 16. Gamers, I had made the comment earlier in the show about not sleeping on using the lightning rod as one of your elemental abilities in combat. Now, at first, I gotta be honest with you, I was kind of put off by this ability and not really that impressed with it. And in general, the lightning elemental abilities were really just completely not something I considered in my every battle repertoire. But I gotta tell you, once I realized and understood how to fully take advantage of using that lightning rod, oh man, it is crucial, not to mention a must-have for me when it comes to battle. Now, the lightning rod is essentially, when you use this ability, it will leave essentially a ball of lightning in the middle of the battlefield. And the idea is to try to get enemies to be lured towards it and try to strike it in the process of trying to strike you. Now, in addition to that, though, every time you strike that ball of lightning while the enemies are nearby and close enough to it, it will lash out in sparks and attack them with each successive hit that you administer to it. Now, it doesn't damage you at all, so this is perfect and just awesome. So anytime you stagger an enemy, I would recommend trying to immediately drop a lightning rod and then just go ham. I mean, utilizing multiple elemental abilities and combos and everything you can. I mean, that's obviously what I do anyways, anytime, and I'm sure you guys do who have played the game as well. Anytime you stagger an enemy, you're just going ham on them. So once you get that lightning rod, I would highly recommend dropping the lightning rod and then go ham on them, because it acts as kind of like a damage multiplier in a way. And if you're like me and you're trophy hunting and you're trying to get all the trophies or as much as you can in a playthrough, there is a trophy for inflicting 50,000 damage on an enemy while staggered. That's not a boss, or in the heroes or halls of virtue or whatever it's called, where you can actually go in there and you can train up your combat skills. It has to be in an actual battle that's not a boss fight or not in the halls of virtue. And this is the way, in my opinion, to do it. Utilizing that lightning rod as a damage multiplier, I'm telling you, it works. It just try it. Trust me. Don't sleep on lightning rod. Now, the other real quick thing I wanted to tell you is one thing me and my wife realized is certain side quests, if you complete them, they actually have an effect later on in the game, and there will be a callback to certain side quests. So just a FYI, if you want to make sure to have access to certain things all throughout the course of the game, I'd highly recommend to make sure to complete side quests as you come across them, because things do happen over the course of the story that will prohibit you from having access to those same side quests again. So make sure you're constantly doing the side quests so that you're on the up and up, and that as things progress in the story, you can see completing those previous side quests affects your current and ongoing journey. Now let's go check out this week's Captain's Decree. Gamers, this week on Captain's Decree, I am asking, so what is it that Ubisoft can do to prevent ruining Assassin's Creed yet again? So for me, I think it really comes down to the oversaturation piece. I really think they need to hold back too many entries in the series in a given year. Too close of a time span, too many games in that time span, you're just asking to push people away. Now, don't get me wrong, you're going to have those diehard fans out there like myself that'll be there for every single one, but in all reality, you think about the 15 million people who bought Black Flag, as I had stated earlier. Out of that 15 million, the majority of that number is not the hardcore fan base. I'm sorry, but it's not. To reach those kinds of numbers in anything, you have to reach a broad general audience. And that game did that. That's one reason why it sold so well. You're not going to be able to do that and be successful for every single one of these games that you potentially put out. So if you have six games in a year, you might get one or two of them that reach that kind of success. But by the third or fourth or fifth or sixth game, the general audience is probably going to have moved on at that point. Be like, I've already done like one or two of those this year. I'm good, man. Whereas the hardcore fan base, sure. But out of that 15 mil, I'm just guesstimating here. I would guesstimate that 15 mil, maybe half, maybe even under half of that is actually the hardcore fan base. Now, outside of just tempering the amount of releases, I think that it's not just about the amount of releases, but about the quality of the titles that you do release. So I get it. You got Assassin's Creed Jade that's coming out for mobile, and that is a different demographic than I would say Assassin's Creed Red is going to get when it comes out, or even this year with Assassin's Creed Mirage. You know, Mirage is for the home console gamer, and it's not for the portable-minded gamer, whereas Jade is supposed to be catered to and developed with the mobile gamer in mind, because it's only available to play on mobile. I could kind of see you getting away with both of those in a given year, but, and maybe even VR, because these are kind of like specific different markets, but you got to spread them out. So maybe in the beginning of the year, you have Nexus, and then in the middle of the year, you have Jade or whatever the equivalent is of that at that point in time, portable game. And then you have your typical big fall release as far as October, November, whichever month you decide for that given year entitled to do so. I think that is not too bad of an idea, but I really think that anything more than three releases in a given year is just too much if they decide to go that route. And even then, I would still say continuing along another piece to ensure that you don't have too much content and push people away, I think is to still give a good window of time in between those major Assassin's Creed releases. And what I mean when I say that is things like Mirage, or in the future we have Assassin's Creed Red, which is supposed to be the next massive, huge Assassin's Creed game in the series. So when Red comes out, say it comes out in October of the year that it releases, I still would say give 2 years before you release, say, Assassin's Creed Hexae. I'd give 2 years for Red to breathe, for people to get through this massive game at its base, as well as probably any DLC or expansions or extra content that you're going to inevitably add to it. So I would say those are some core things that Ubisoft needs to do to ensure that they maintain interest and they maintain excitement around the Assassin's Creed franchise. And again, I do think it's okay to branch out with different types and styles of Assassin's Creed, and that therefore it's why I said mix it up throughout the year. Mobile, VR, your hardcore or your core game. But don't have too many of those release. Anything above three, I'm just saying, I feel is really going to be just too much. We look back at history, and history, ironically, Assassin's Creed being a series focused around history, history teaches us lessons. And history tells us, with Assassin's Creed specifically, that if you release two brand new core games on the same day, and if you continue to release a game every single year, it's going to be too much and push people away. So hopefully, all I can say is that Ubisoft has learned from the past, as many of those who enter the Animus also learn. That'll do it for this week's episode. I hope you've enjoyed your time aboard the SS Gamer. You can join its crew by reaching out to me via email at lostatseagaming365@gmail.com, or you can search for Hulking Yoda on the Xbox, PlayStation, and Nintendo Switch networks. You can also find me on social media on Instagram at lostatseagaming, as well as on Twitter at lostatseagaming, the number one. Thank you for listening, and until the sea says otherwise, we'll keep sailing.